All right.
So, yes, welcome to the Consumer Choice Center cast. I'm joined by my colleague, David Clement, who's the North American Affairs Manager at the Consumer Choice Center. And we're coming to you with some great and expert analysis on how consumers fared after Canada's federal election. So we got a big federal election that just happened in Canada just on Monday. The results have come in. The votes have been tallied up, and now we have an idea about what the future of Canada will be. Considering there's a lot of consumer issues at stake, we wanted to sit down, chat, and figure out what consumers can really care about or what might change for them or what could be better for them going forward. So, David, let's hit you with, I guess, the big question. You are a consumer advocate. You're someone who's been involved at every level of public life, of business, being a consumer on the ground. What does it mean, these results from the election, from the point of view of a consumer?
Well, I think it's really a mixed bag. There were a couple fairly large consumer issues that came up in the campaign. So things like cell phone, internet pricing in Canada. So Canadian consumers are kind of historically overcharged, is what many would say, in terms of those services. So that actually did come up in the campaign. That was a positive. There were some patient care questions in terms of healthcare and pharmaceuticals that were issues. And that was obviously an important discussion to have. There's lots of implications in terms of how any of those policies would be rolled out. One thing that was largely left out almost entirely from the conversation was cannabis. Both the pros, the cons, what would be changed. It was essentially par for the course, which from our perspective, I think shows a little bit of a lack of self-reflection, unfortunately, on the government side. And so hopefully...
And to remind viewers, by the way, it was Justin Trudeau
who won
for the minority government, I think it's important to say. So tell us a little bit about the results and what that means for future governing.
Yeah, so we have a minority government. For Americans listening, it's complicated. For British people listening, this is business as usual. Essentially, the Liberals got the most seats. Justin Trudeau is still the prime minister, but he does not have a majority of the seats, which means that he will have to govern either by formal coalition, so actually making an agreement with one of the other smaller parties, or he'll have to govern issue by issue and get support from some of the opposition parties to pass legislation. So this isn't something that's uncommon in Canada, but it does raise a lot of questions in terms of where the Liberals are going to have to compromise or alter their policy points to accommodate for the wants of the other parties. And so that's really where the consumer impact comes in, because it just depends on who they're going to need to get the support. So like an example in the energy space, the question about pipelines and access for Canadian oil, that's going to be a real roadblock with the two opposition parties that they would traditionally partner with, which is the NDP and the Bloc Québécois. And so I think from a consumer point of view, in terms of that expansion and things like gas prices and carbon taxes, it's probably not looking too good under this minority government.
And talk about actually, because there was a lot in the campaign about obviously the oil industry, and it seems there weren't many positive words. I think there was a huge focus, obviously, on climate change and the impact, and the Liberals were trying to out-campaign the Greens and the NDP, saying they're better and they can do more. And then there's this entire question of the Trans Mountain pipeline and oil moving to market. So what do you think will be kind of the future of that debate, or how could that change perhaps in the next couple of months or years?
Yeah, so the Liberals tried to position themselves as saying that they had a climate policy that was aggressive but realistic. So they very much cast the NDP and the Greens as having unrealistic positions, and then they cast the Conservatives, whether it's accurate or not, as almost like the anti-climate change party. So in terms of that campaign strategy, ultimately to do anything on the climate, they're going to have to make some sort of coalition with the Greens, the NDP, or the Bloc. And that almost certainly means higher prices. It almost certainly means higher taxes on what are deemed like high carbon industries or products and things like that. So that's definitely problematic from a consumer point of view, because I mean, we're talking about, this can be sound cliche to say, but we're talking about driving to work, we're talking about heating your house, we're talking about business costs, we're talking about anything that involves keeping the lights on, yeah. Possibly having increased costs. We know that those get passed on to consumers. And so
the federal carbon tax, there are certain provinces that have their own kind of carbon tax, but mm-hmm. for the carbon tax, when did that officially go into effect? And I know that was a bit of a sticking point, really only between conservatives and liberals. It seems the rest of the parties were all in on the carbon tax, unless I'm mistaken.
Yeah. So the federal carbon tax, I actually don't know the date in which it actually was fully implemented.
I think it was this year or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know that one of the debates around the carbon tax was the liberals couldn't commit to how high it was going to go. Mm-hmm. And when asked and when pressed, they wouldn't give any concrete figures about how high they're actually going to raise it. And so the balance here is from the conservative side, they're saying don't rapidly increase the carbon tax. You're going to increase costs exponentially on Canadian families. And then on the NDP, Green, and Bloc side, they're in many instances have pushed for significantly higher rates in terms of the carbon tax to try and curb consumer behavior. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is right now is that reliance on those let's say fossil fuels is relatively inelastic. Mm-hmm. So they'd have to increase taxation exponentially to have any kind of desired impact on reducing emissions from it, which doesn't include the fact that Canada is not en masse in terms of a global scale actually a significant portion of emissions.
Yeah, and still the other point being that, and I want to ask you about Alberta later, but mm-hmm. the fact that oil production, petroleum products are actually such a huge part of the Canadian economy.
Yep.
And, you know, this is an industry that employs so many people, and there are so many mm-hmm. industries that are kind of third party to that and are used as product suppliers and all the rest. And it seems as if there was this kind of pitting back and forth, and there wasn't really talk about, apart from the lofty sort of, we're going to transition everybody to green jobs, whatever that means. But there wasn't this kind of focus on how to revitalize that industry, really. It seemed as if it was all negative.
Yeah, I think for the most part, the Liberals were feeling the pressure from the progressive side of the voter base to be stricter and to be more heavy-handed. I think a better approach would have just been to declare kind of energy neutrality, so end things like subsidies that exist in the fossil fuel sector. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, and the Liberals have kind of done this, I think they did it the wrong way in terms of pipelines. So, I mean, that's definitely the environmentally friendly way of transporting oil and gas. Mm-hmm. It's way safer than tanker or train, which in theory should be.
Line, by the way, it was like, you know, better to have it by pipeline than by train.
Yeah, exactly. And that should resonate with folks in BC who are anti-tanker. I mean, they have tankers off their coast all the time, and that carries risks. It should also have been received well by folks in Quebec who dealt with a horrific tragedy. Unfortunately, it wasn't, and the political appetite in Quebec is not conducive to the pipeline debate, especially going through Quebec. So we have this problem now where the Liberals have nationalized a pipeline, which is the environmentally friendly way to do. They've nationalized a pipeline that the private sector was ready to build. if they got approval, which makes a lot of people on the more fiscally conservative side of things scratch their head. But they now have this hurdle of how do they advance that cause, knowing that their opposition, the conservatives, are irritated because the liberals bought the pipeline, and the NDP and the Greens and the Bloc are irritated because they don't think that we should have pipelines at all.
Sure.
So the liberals are kind of stuck in this conundrum where they've irritated all of the opposition, and now they have the task of trying to legislate with a minority on a huge file that feeds a lot of Western resentment, especially in Alberta, and talks of Western separation and things like that, mostly fueled by the fact that they just feel beaten up by federal politicians. They don't feel like they've been represented well. And that's gonna just create a whole whack of different problems in terms of Canadian unity and all sorts of questions in terms of how the country is actually governed as a whole.
Yeah. And that's something that was a little bit discussed. You know, it was the relationship between the U.S. and Canada. Obviously, the U.S. is Canada's largest trading partner. It's the, I think, biggest trade relationship in the world. You know, the freer borders and allowing people to export on both sides has been awesome for both economies, and it's incredibly important for Canada. I don't know, you could foresee a situation where if there's continued, you know, stymieing and roadblocks that are put up when it comes to just, you know, the oil and oil sands, everything's already there, right? Mm-hmm. It's just about getting it out. And I think that's always the contention, but the U.S. is a ready and willing buyer. We had this whole debate in the U.S. with the Keystone Pipeline and whether or not we want to have this. And, you know, it doesn't matter because there's private projects that have already sprung up and they're exporting natural gas. And now that the U.S. is exporting natural gas like crazy, and you could see a move away from Canada, which would be like incredibly devastating for the economy and everything that flows around it. But there wasn't much discussion of that.
No, there wasn't. And unfortunately, on that trade question with the U.S., most of the discussions were actually negative.
Yeah.
So the NDP wanting to reopen NAFTA and reopen NAFTA to get a better deal to protect Canada, which from a Canadian consumer point of view would be disastrous. I mean, we're talking about a trade relationship where more trade crosses the border in Detroit in a week than goes to Japan in a year.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those problems where it's out of mind, out of sight. We just go to the store and we buy things from the U.S. or other international markets, and we kind of assume that that's the way things will always be.
Yeah.
But the reason that those products exist here and the reason why we have any sort of competition in a lot of these consumer goods is because of free trade deals, whether it's with Europe or with countries in Asia or the United States. It's those agreements that allow for that competition and that product variety to exist here. And so,
and fear trade, you know, that was, you know, there wasn't much celebration of that. And you see the same happening on the Democratic side in the United States, where trade, free trade, is brought up as this terrible boogeyman. God forbid people trade freely and voluntarily and create value for both sides. But, you know, what do you think is going to be the future of trade negotiations? Obviously, this Liberal government can't be faulted for not pursuing free trade. There was tough negotiations in Europe that ended up with Christiana Freeland crying because of what happened in Belgium. But, you know, what's the future of, you know, how the Liberals are going to approach trade going forward? I mean, the way that anyone else would see it is, look, you got to be progressive during election time, and then you just get back to, you know, moderate governing.
Yeah, and this is something where I would love to see the conservatives be more pro-free trade.
Mm-hmm.
When what Andrew Scheer did is he essentially criticized the liberals for not getting a good enough deal in terms of protecting the supply managed sector, which certainly isn't fiscally conservative, and it isn't a free trade.
Real quick, supply management is. You've written about this a lot, and there's an entire bevy of articles that David has written on our website, consumerchoicecenter.org, about that.
Yeah. So it's basically just, in a nutshell, protections that highly tax foreign products, specifically dairy, poultry, and eggs, so much so that it keeps U.S. products, but also European products out of the Canadian market. There's a quota system, so it's almost like buying a taxi license. So in order to be a dairy farmer, you have to buy the license per cow from the government, which is insane. But it's a powerful political lobby, and it's really distorted the trade discussion so much so that the Liberals, I think, should have been commended for their effort in trying to keep NAFTA in the face of in the U.S., you have anti-trade sentiments coming from Trump and the populist right, and you have it from the AOC, Bernie Sanders, progressive left. And the Liberals, in my opinion, did a fairly good job of defending free trade and defending Canadian consumers in that sense. What I would have loved to have seen is the Conservatives go at it from a free trade perspective rather than a protectionist perspective, and push them to be more pro-free trade and open our market more so to foreign industry and to international business.
Yeah. So, and we see that a lot more now that the European free trade agreement is kind of coming into force, and mm-hmm. you know, you can't just start exporting to Canada tomorrow. There's a lot of stuff that people have to think about and plan and figure out the routes and logistics. So there could be a lot from that.
Of course, and I mean, from the purist perspective, a lot of these free trade agreements are criticized because they're in many senses managed trade, mm-hmm. but they certainly move the ball in the right direction. So the hope here is that what I would actually love to see, I doubt we would ever see it because the partisanship is too toxic right now, but I would love to see the Liberals pivot on trade and actually get Conservatives to vote for their free trade policies, because that puts them well into a majority standpoint on anything that would be voted in that sense. And so that would be a no-brainer for me. I don't think the Liberals have the political capital to partner with the Conservatives on anything. But that would be a real win, not only for Canadian industry, but for Canadian consumers.
And one thing that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to come back to was cannabis. And obviously Canada is the largest and really only country that has legalized cannabis in an institutionalized way in which it's actually a market where you can buy things. Many issues that you've written a lot about and we've discussed, but I'm wondering, you know, what missed opportunities were there when it came directly to cannabis? I mean, obviously it's something that Justin Trudeau was able to get passed and was able to implement, and a lot of people were commending him for that, but it wasn't really brought up in any meaningful way as a new sector.
So there's two sides of this. There's the domestic side. So nobody talked about cannabis policy in the election. Basically, Andrew Scheer was asked if he would keep it legal, and he said that he would. But that was the extent of the conversation, and there was really no push from the progressive side of politics either. And so there were no discussions about what needs to be corrected here domestically to curb the black market, taxation. I mean, something as simple as getting rid of the sin tax on medical cannabis should have been something that brought all of the parties together, right? It should be something that progressives should be standing up for, because we're talking about people's medicine. And on the conservative side,
we've talked a lot about this. Why do you think there's not as much, I guess, understanding or just general analysis on what the cannabis industry means and the differentiation between the products? Because obviously we've written, talked about this, you've testified before. I'm wondering, why isn't that there's not as much expertise in this? Why aren't there lawmakers that are learning from other experiments or even trying to understand what these companies are doing? Because it seems as if there's just a, you know, this is always kept in the background, and it's always been schlepped over to the health department.
Yeah, I think it largely comes down to poor opposition. So they don't face the heat when it comes to the opposition. And I place a lot of the blame here on the Conservatives, because the Conservatives are trying to figure out, I mean, they are pro-legalization now, kind of.
But that's fairly new, right?
Yeah, it's fairly new. What would have been a much better strategy for the Conservatives, which we've seen from Conservatives in the United States, is once it's legal, okay, what do we do? Well, we do what Conservatives are supposed to do, and we approach this with a market mentality. I mean, if you look at the medical market in a state like Oklahoma, certainly not a progressive state in terms of its political leanings, but they have now legal medical cannabis, a relatively open market in terms of who can enter the dispensary side and the production side. They very much approached it as Republicans have kind of traditionally done with all businesses. Okay, what are the rules that we have to have to ensure safety? And then how do we lean on the private sector as much as possible to get this done and to get it done so that it serves patient needs as best as possible? Yeah. We don't have that conservative viewpoint yet in Ottawa pushing the Liberals on that front. And the progressive side of politics haven't really been focused on tax policy or the regulatory side of things. They've been focused on things like criminal records, which I applaud them for. So sure. Things like getting rid of criminal records for possession. But nobody's really pressing the government on it. And so without the opposition holding their feet to the fire, they don't really need to they don't need to self-reflect because they're not being forced to. Ultimately, we're paying the price. I mean, the black market is still quite prevalent nationally across the board. We have all sorts of issues in terms of product variety. I mean, edibles, extracts, and concentrates were only legalized last week.
It's so still those, not available as far as
no,
I know.
They're not. They will be soon, but they're not available. But even when they are available, the retail access is poor, taxation is high, moving products across provincial boundaries is...
Yeah, my package hasn't arrived yet, so I know.
Yeah, exactly. So... it would have been nice to see.
Do you see momentum? This is something that we've been able to garner because we're obviously very active in different markets and countries. Mm-hmm. And you can see that there's plenty of business players, you know, investors, and a lot of people got rich very quick on the Canadian cannabis sector. And a lot of consumers have really liked some of the products, but there's been a lot of problems. Do you think there's going to be a push more from the industry side to directly influence the government to perhaps either change things, modernize things, you know, change the timing of when products can be released, these kind of things? Mm-hmm.
I hope so. What I would really like to see, so there was an interview on BNN, which is Canada's kind of business news network, where they interviewed Bruce Lynn, who was the former CEO of Canopy, and he raised a very interesting argument in terms of our trade and our kind of trade ambassadors and their relationships around the world. For any other industry, they would be basically cheering on and advocating on behalf of Canadian interests globally. Mm-hmm. But they've been relatively silent on cannabis. I would love to see a pivot from this new Trudeau government internationally, where they're pushing for things like legalization, whether it's medical or rec internationally. One, because it's the right thing to do. And it's very much in Trudeau's kind of progressive mantra. So I think it fits in there. But two, it definitely benefits Canadian industry and all of the people who are now involved in this growing industry if Canada can kind of capitalize on its first mover benefit or first mover advantage, especially in the early days. So it is kind of weird to see from a trade and expansion point of view, the government be so silent internationally on that front. I really wish they took more of a leadership role in pushing that. But again,
a good example of, you know, on if you look at a microcosm, if you look in the United States at Mitch McConnell, comes from Kentucky. There's a huge hemp economy there, a lot of farmers, people who would like to grow other products and were very much. He became the number one cheerleader for hemp.
Yeah.
You know, this is Senate majority leader, a guy with a lot of power. And because of that additional political capital, now you have hemp that is legal across the U.S., but you don't really have that in Canada. You don't have individual members sort of championing it. What do you think we need in Canada to be able to push that narrative to the next level?
Yeah, that's a good question. Some of it comes from the opposition. Some of it comes from the way in which Canadian politics works. So Canadian politics is much more party-bound than in the U.S., in terms of like whipped votes. So it would be very difficult for like a single member of parliament to be like Mitch McConnell in that sense, where they really start championing something that can benefit their constituents. We don't see a lot of that. I mean, we see it with oil and gas in Alberta. which is part of the reason why
you had a huge CBD farm in Mississauga or something like this.
Yeah, you're not going to have the liberal candidate in Mississauga advocate on behalf of expansion or market opportunities like you would see in oil and gas. And I think part of that is it's still new. And there's some timidness, but it'd be great to get over that and to kind of move past
that. I think, you know, it's the stigma. That's something that we've discussed a lot before, the stigma that still exists. You know, if you go out for a joint versus if you go out for a beer, you know, it's very different sectors of the population that are going to enjoy either one of those products.
Yep.
That's kind of a crazy thing. One more thing I wanted to talk to you about was healthcare. This was brought up by many of the leaders, obviously pitching sort of their own view on it. But Canada's healthcare system, I know a lot of people on both sides of the border like to paint this black and white picture of you have this beautiful kind of government-controlled healthcare model in Canada versus a totally free, bare-bones market healthcare system in the U.S.
Yeah.
What was brought up on healthcare in the context of the election campaign? And now that the Liberals have won, what changes or things will happen with the healthcare system mandated by the Canada Health Act and then carried out by the provinces?
Yeah, so the one big issue was PharmaCare. So kind of a nationalized PharmaCare system that was pushed by pretty much everybody on the left. And you can understand the how enticing that might sound in terms of it's almost like the Walmart model of drug procurement where rather than having local or regional bodies negotiate drug prices, you have the federal government do it. They have much more bargaining power. The problem, and my colleague Fred and I have written about this, is that you have this growing tension where patients in the U.S. are coming across the border to fill prescriptions and causing drug shortages, pretty serious drug shortages in Canada. So our concern on the PharmaCare side in terms of access, is that if there's additional kind of price control mechanisms and kind of a nationalized buying system, what's ultimately going to happen is it makes the Canadian pharmaceutical space more attractive than it already is for U.S. patients. Mm-hmm. And what we see now is we see shortages from everything from like acne cream to some more serious medications. And so something has to be done to kind of address that problem. Nobody's really spoken about it in terms of what they're going to do. And it's almost one of those issues where the more you get government involved, the more complicated the solutions get because it just becomes harder and harder to fix. The other side, which often goes unignored, often goes ignored, is the impact that PharmaCare has on innovative medicine in Canada. Sure. So manufacturers, whether they're in Europe or in the United States, are going to be hesitant to roll out new medicines in Canada if they know that those medicines can then just leak across the border into the United States and other markets in which they have to negotiate in. So it becomes an instance where it could be seen like the federal government's negotiating in bad faith because they're arguing or negotiating for better pricing for Canada, but then those lower price medicines go into other markets. And so I think it's realistic to assume that if this trend continues, these manufacturers are just going to pause the rollout for new medicine in Canada and have a longer delay than they already have. So rather than waiting a year, so something becomes available in the US, it's not available in Canada, usually it takes, I forget what the specifics are, but let's say it's a year, that wait time could get longer to try and ensure that you don't have that leakage across the border. And so, again, it's one of those issues where you can totally understand the desire to want to lower drug prices for Canadian patients. But in doing so, you can't forget where a lot of these medicines could end up. And you can't forget that it ultimately will have an impact on the medicine that is available in Canada, because it's one thing to negotiate for lower prices, but the key there is a negotiation that has to happen. And if the groups on the other side of the discussion don't want to have that, don't want to go to the bargaining table for a year or longer after a particular drug is approved, that creates some equity problems in terms of what patients internationally have access to and what Canadian patients have access to.
Especially if you've got Bernie Sanders leading, 18 school buses of patients going to buy drugs in Canada, that's gonna mess up a lot of things there. And whoever's anti the American healthcare system, they're gonna hate it even more when all these patients start crossing the border to get their fix.
and I don't blame those people for doing that. I mean, they're just responding to incentives. I don't think there's anything nefarious there. But yeah, it only gets worse unless some of these blind spots are addressed. And at least from right now, I haven't seen any of them addressed by anyone. It's almost as if they've created these promises and these goals without really looking at any of the externalities, which is pretty close to the definition of bad public policy when you're just legislating on good intentions. And so they have to address these blind spots if they want to have if they want to even remotely have their policy suggestions be successful.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of good suggestions that obviously you've made along the way, and all of our fellows and everyone at CCC. So there's more stuff to be written about this, more things to be debated. But I think overall, David, you gave a pretty good explanation. How a consumer is supposed to look at the election, what the impact is. I guess now we just keep on keeping on, trying to get the ideas injected and hopefully influence a couple of people to make sure we promote more choice, get people. Yeah. Ability to have better health and science and lifestyle, consumer goods, all the rest.
Yeah, I think the real balance here, especially with this kind of left-wing coalition that's merging, is understanding the negative implications of the various policies. So like a perfect example would be plastic bans. Mm-hmm. I could definitely see that coming about at the federal level with pressure from the NDP and the Greens. I totally understand the desire to limit plastic waste and where it ends up. The problem is that you have to evaluate the externality. So something simple as like the transition from plastic to paper bags actually doesn't benefit the environment at all. The Danish Environment Ministry has already basically declared that is a worse outcome for the environment in terms of total emissions and waste and all of that. And so it's, again, one of those instances where these ideas may sound promising, like they're going to fix apparent problems, but there's a blind spot in terms of what the alternatives are and where the externalities are. And it just kind of further highlights the need for neutrality. We see this, something that you've talked about, the whole meatless versus meat debate. I mean, the best argument here is for the government to just be hands off and let the market feed consumer demand, which is where we've seen a lot of these new innovative products come about. I would like them to take that approach across the board and see where market forces can solve these problems by simply just responding to what consumers want, whether it's electric vehicles or alternatives to plastic waste or questions around the emissions from meat production and things like that. A more neutral position.
Of state and burgers. That's very important. Yes. It's just important as separation between church and state.
Yeah, there you go. Yes. Yeah. Leave my burgers, leave my pizza alone.
Exactly. Cool. Yeah. Note, thanks so much. David Clement is North American Affairs Manager at Consumer Choice Center. You can find all of his written work and contributions there. Plenty of his videos and testimonies online. David, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you.